Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, January 30th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a weekly examination of the news media and the stories they focus on. I'm Mike McKean, Futures Lab Director at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Our regular panelists are here as well, Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis, both faculty colleagues from the Missouri School of Journalism. On this week's program, Steve Croft of 60 Minutes interviews President Obama and just-departed Secretary of State Hillary Clinton together. Lots of people watched, and lots of critics called the questions soft. The parent company of CBS News muzzles its tech journalists at CNET once again. One unintended consequence might be a tougher time for big media companies hoping to own newspapers and broadcast outlets in the same city. Two of the country's premier newspapers look to technology for answers this week, while the Chicago NPR station hopes to build audience the old-fashioned way, one smart baby at a time. And we're getting sneak previews of some of the 2013 Super Bowl ads. One of them is already drawing fire for its alleged racial insensitivity. Steve Croft had already scored three exclusive interviews with President Obama in the past, after his election in 2008, after the killing of Osama bin Laden, and as he kicked off his reelection campaign. So when the White House called last week offering a 30-minute sit-down with the president and Hillary Clinton, Croft was ready to oblige. The 60 Minutes correspondent is a serious, hard-nosed journalist, but his questions of the pair, including this one, led many to accuse him of lobbing softballs.
It's no secret that your aides cautioned you against, actually were against you offering Secretary Clinton this job, and you were just as determined not to take it. And you avoided taking her phone calls for a while because you were afraid she was going to say no. Why were you so insistent about wanting her to be Secretary of State?
Well, I was a big admirer of Hillary's before our primary battles and the general election. You know, her discipline, her stamina, her thoughtfulness, her ability to project, I think, and make clear issues that are important to the American people.
Now, criticism of the Croft interview didn't just emanate from the president's opponents. Of course, they did step in, but plenty of journalists and media analysts also thought that he went incredibly easy on Obama and Clinton. For example, Connor Friedersdorf at The Atlantic listed every question from the interview, and then he said the broadcast should diminish Croft's standing. Lee, he even argued that comedian Jon Stewart is more hard-hitting with the president.
Comedian Jon Stewart may be more hard-hitting with the president, but probably not in this setting, besides which Jon Stewart is funnier. And if you've seen the president on Jon Stewart, you know that you're not getting any better answers out of him on Jon Stewart than you are in this particular interview. President Obama, whatever you may think of his politics, is not a particularly unpracticed person when it comes to dealing with media. Having said that, when we were going to talk about this today, I thought, boy, what's a hard-hitting question that I really think needed to be answered at this particular time? Well, you're not going to get anything out of Benghazi, because that's already subject to congressional debate. You're not going to get anything about what's the future of foreign policy, because you're in the middle of a transition of Secretary of State. So I tried hard to think about what are some hard-hitting things that I would like to have known, and I didn't come up with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I got to say, though, it is true. Both Obama and Clinton are very savvy media manipulators, as most good politicians are, Charles. They weren't likely to make news, as Lee mentioned, but I still think that Croft, you know, this was a very rare opportunity, and shouldn't he have at least asked harder questions and maybe focused on some of the current foreign policy issues, even if he knew he wasn't going to get any detailed answers? I mean, just asking the question and watching on camera live what they say back to you sometimes is useful.
Absolutely. And there's something to be said for asking I don't even know if the right term is tougher questions. How about substantive questions, yeah. policy-oriented questions? Yeah. So many of Croft's questions are kind of, I don't know, they're the stuff of 17 magazine. Like, how did you feel? And she wouldn't return your phone calls. It's just all so kumbaya-ish. I mean, what I would have preferred is just some questions. Actually, here's a formulation that many of us have used as journalists. Your critics allege that blank. How do you respond? That would have been nice about a half dozen times.
Now, I know at the very beginning of the interview, because I watched it live on 60 Minutes. Well, it wasn't a live interview. It was taped on Friday, but I watched the show on TV. And Croft did say up front, they only gave us 30 minutes, so it's very hard to get into things substantive in that amount of time. And there's some sense that you should be deferential to the president, especially when you're interviewing him. And I guess it was in the White House or wherever they interviewed him. So, are either of those, you know, legitimate reasons for not asking the kind of question that you might impertinently ask in a news conference?
They're not legitimate reasons. I mean, what I was always taught, so this is back to, you know, early formative, is you honor the office but not the man. I would assume that that goes for the Secretary of State. You honor the office but not the woman. So I think that politeness and deference is appropriate, regardless of who is sitting in those chairs. To be intimidated and to not ask tough questions because you're also trying to be deferential. No, that works at cocktail parties, but probably not in journalism.
Yeah, we have a link to the piece from The Atlantic, and I thought you should take a look at it because not only did he detail every question, but he also compared this interview that Steve Croft did with one of his 60 Minute colleagues, Scott Pelley, when Pelley was doing a one-on-one with former President George W. Bush a few years ago. And boy, Pelley didn't let up on the gas mm-hmm. at all. I mean, he pressed Bush hard about foreign policy. Is that, as some people would argue, bias? Is that not wanting to give up your in with the president, since Croft has had several exclusives as a result of the way he's conducted those interviews?
Well, it certainly has something to do with where in the presidency the questions fell. I mean, this was a Bush who was leaving. Right. And so you almost felt like Pelley was kind of kicking him while he was down, especially about Iraq. That having been said, though, this is one where, you know, with Republicans with their hair on fire, have every reason to have their hair on fire on this one. They should have put Pelley on Obama. He asked way better questions.
Yeah.
The question, though, and I think this is what separates the conspiracy theorists from legitimate media critics, is that we're not drawing any inferences as to causality here. A lot of people are out there, and it's kind of silly. That having been said, just go read the questions, as you said. I mean, they were a lot harder hitting.
You know, there were at least some supporters of the president and Croft who said that Croft actually did us a favor by simply letting us see how much they liked each other and how thoughtful and intelligent they were as leaders. Make anything of that?
Well, I still don't know whether they like each other. As Charles said, they're both very practiced. So what I see is not, you know, is not necessarily what's there. I mean, I think that the temptation, what journalists want to do, is to go do a contemporary Doris Kearns Goodwin and say team of rivals. Well, if you've read that book, what you know is that Lincoln and his rivals interpersonally didn't wind up liking each other any better for having spent those four very contentious years in Washington, D.C. So, I mean, whether or not they like each other to me is immaterial. Can they work together? Did they accomplish something for the country? In what way? How? Those are the important questions.
You know, there was one thing that the journalists who didn't get the interview, Charles, were trying to tease out of it, and that's whether or not that this particular interview, which was really rare, the president and the secretary of state together, was somehow an endorsement of Hillary over Joe Biden in 2016. What do you think of that?
Yeah, tea leaf reading. I mean, Hillary's
with
not going to
Hillary's glasses.
And she won't even – right now, I have absolutely no plans, and she's going to stick behind that forever. I just thought – I mean, I do think it was a rare and somewhat wonderful opportunity to ask a couple of pretty good questions, if not about Benghazi, then how about other hotspots in the world, and get them sort of playing off each other in an interesting journalistic way. And instead, what we got was just hand-holding.
Well, we're going to move on to our next item, and we're not going to spend too much time repeating all the details, but I did want to bring the audience up to date on a story we first discussed a couple of weeks ago. This was the decision by CBS Inc. that its technology news site, CNET, could no longer review the products of companies that CBS was suing. That hastily established policy came in the wake, as you'll remember, of CBS telling CNET it had to pull an award that it was prepared to bestow on the television DVR known as the Hopper. Well, this week the policy was invoked again. CNET was writing a story this time about Aereo. That's a company that streams live TV programs for free through the Roku service. Well, CBS is suing Aereo as well for failing to get network permission to rebroadcast its show. So the CNET story points out the policy. It says it's not going to be able to review Aereo going down the road. And then I thought Lee proceeded with a very delicate little dance. I mean, they talked about the product some, and then they went into some detail about the lawsuit as well. So, I mean, how well did they handle that? Was that sort of a wink-wink that we're going to work around the policy, or was it just another example of some pretty heavy-handed censorship on CBS's part?
I tend to see this more as censorship on CBS's part and sort of, you know, once you've plunged your dagger into the insect and it squiggles around a little bit on the paper. And that was actually kind of what I saw going here. The other thing is, I can't believe that CBS in this day and age is doing this about this particular thing, because of course it's all over the web. Anybody who wants to learn about this doesn't have to do any sort of a sophisticated web search to find out a ton. So for me, it's in the category of, what were you thinking?
I think also, Charles, doesn't it sort of point to the futility of a policy that tries to draw a line between news coverage and reviews? I mean, here's another example of how hard, if not impossible, that is.
It was dumb when they did it the first time. It's astonishingly, breathtakingly dumb when they did it a second time, because I fully expected in the intervening weeks after we first covered the story that they would sort of sheepishly go, yeah, our bad. Reviews, editorial content, all the same. We're going to leave you alone. Do your work, CNET. Instead, they seem to be intruding even further. I mean, they must have a little phalanx of lawyers sitting in CNET that's reviewing everything they're doing to see if it's somebody they've sued.
Well, and Lee, CBS may have sort of screwed the pooch for themselves and for other big media companies, because one of the unintended consequences is the fact that there are several big media companies, and for years now they've been arguing with the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, that they ought to relax the rules on what's called cross-ownership, meaning can you own a newspaper and, say, a broadcast outlet in the same city? Well, now the FCC, and there's a 2-to-1 majority Democrats on the panel, were about to release some rules, hold hearings on rules that would have, in fact, loosened those rules a little bit. Still can't own a newspaper and a TV station in the same city, but you could own newspapers and radio stations under this proposal. Well, now opponents are looking at this CNET thing, and they're saying, see, there you go. Big media can't be trusted to promote and protect these voices that challenge their economic interests.
Two things I want to say about that. First, we have a long tradition, we meaning journalists, and I don't care what media organization you work for, of covering everybody as a watchdog except ourselves and except our industry. And it's taken somebody like Jon Stewart to come along and actually report on journalism and hold journalism up to some sort of account in certain instances. So I see this really as a continuation of a trend that's probably been out there, at least in my understanding of it, for the last 50 years. That's on the one side. On the other hand, if we're ever going to get any audience back, we have to become willing to be an honest broker. And that's what I find so astoundingly short-sighted, is that you've got a news organization that can't look at itself and say, credibility, it's the only thing we have to sell. And so what are we going to do? We're going to give it away too.
And yeah. It's this remarkably dated vision of the impact of their control in the marketplace. They're living in this three-channel world in which they think they can button up CNET's coverage of somebody they're suing, and that'll just take care of it. Like the internet people, anyone can go Google anything instantly and learn everything they want to know about this. So why would you silence as authoritative a voice as they own in CNET? It's just illogical.
Well, many of us believe that technological innovation is critical to the future of the news media, and we saw some stories this week showing how at least two of our prestigious newspapers are testing that proposition once again. First, we'll talk briefly about the New York Times. They announced that they're selecting 3 to 5 early-stage startups who want to work with the paper on partnerships around things such as mobile and social media, advertising, analytics, e-commerce. Charles, I'm wondering, well, first of all, what's in it for the Times, and can it work?
I think it's a fairly inspired idea. They're a little late to the game. I mean, there's certainly all kinds of people doing similar things, but not newspaper companies standing alone. I mean, I think there are probably two or three positive outcomes I could see potentially. One, equity stakes. I mean, they pick winners. They invest in winners. Second of all, joint ventures and collaborations where they see a promising piece of digital technology and they incorporate it into the Times product set in some way. And of course, talent base. You're bringing in some really brilliant people into your building. And I would imagine the Times will, you know, sort of like the developmental squad. And you look down there and you go, that coder right there, we're going to hire that one. He looks really promising, or she's really brilliant. So I think there's several positive outcomes from that.
I should say, too, just as a bit of transparency, we at RJI are actually, along with a lot of other people in the media space, are considering launching our own media technology accelerator. And so, you know, we obviously have an interest in seeing how these things play out.
Well, it reminded me of the RJI concept in that they're going to sort of surround these people with the support and services of the Times, whereas we've talked about that sort of at the university level.
Well, and the second new tech story that came out this week, Lee, was courtesy of the Washington Post. Now, we've talked quite a bit on this program in the past about fact-checking, especially as it relates to political fact-checking. Well, the Washington Post is prototyping a new automated service on its website that's supposed to be able to test claims made by politicians once they're captured on video in real time. They call it the Truth Teller. It's limited, it's glitchy right now, but the paper hopes to improve it. Well, let's say, Lee, that it does work. Can an algorithm really divine the truth any better than real reporters?
On some things, I think it can. If we've got a politician who's out there saying that the earth is flat, I think it will work. I think it will work well. There are two problems that I see with it. One, so much of politics is context. So much political speech is so highly contextualized and coded. And I'm just not sure that anything short of a really active human brain is going to be able to sort of truth tell that in real time. The second thing is that I'm not sure who this is for. In the sense that, let's say I have this, right, and let's say Charles has just been elected to office, and Charles says something that sets the truth-o-meter off for whatever reason.
That would happen instantly.
Yeah. So what am I going to do with that information? What is the audience supposed to do with that information? We have pretty good social scientific evidence to indicate that people will discard information that doesn't agree with their previously arrived at conclusions, no matter how fact-based it might be. Right. So I'm a little puzzled as to who this is exactly supposed to help.
Well, and I'll say, Charles, and I'll say it again because I've said it before, I think it's awfully hard to ascertain a truth about political statements, even if it's a real experienced political journalist following it. Let's say the algorithm works. I still suspect if it's going in real time, whether it's a computer or people doing it, we're going to have a lot of mistakes, a lot of backfilling. I'm not sure what it accomplishes.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes people name things too grandiosely. Instead of truth seeker, maybe they just call it fact checker, because I think you could. I mean, clearly there are algorithms that can produce fact check pretty quickly. So if somebody says it was 763, scour the web, find that number, go, oh, nope, 765. That would be a helpful utility, actually, yeah, to the reader, I think, because you're not trying to get at that metaphysical term truth so much as you're just making sure the factual record is accurate. I was at the MIT Media Lab, I think a year or two ago, and watched a very similar program that may actually now be this. I'm not entirely sure. I was trying to figure out today whether it was the same researchers. The problem is, clearly, I mean, I was just sitting here thinking about that claim that Romney was making during the campaign about the Medicare cuts,
right,
cuts, quote unquote, that Obama was proposing, which actually, if you look at the context, were nothing of the sort, right? Without the context, though, factually true statement.
Well, so Truth Teller or the latest startup or whatever may or may not help grow audiences, but WBEZ, which is the NPR station in Chicago, Lee, they've got a different plan. They've launched an advertising blitz. This starts on Friday, called 2032 Membership Drive. And here's what you're going to be seeing in print, online, on buses, taxis, and T-shirts. Taglines like these: we want listeners tomorrow, go make babies today. And are you an interesting person? Then we want your babies. So this tongue-in-cheek campaign has a serious purpose. Young people, they're not all that likely to listen to public radio, and they're hoping to change that. Can it work? Is it worth $400,000 to try?
I don't know if it's worth $400,000 to try, but it's great on humor value. And besides, it's cold right now in Chicago. So this is maybe perhaps a thing that people might want to engage in. I will say that although that's a generalization about young people, I think it's true. I have noticed, and maybe it's just because of the cohort of young kids who are willing to hang out with me, that I got a lot more folks who are more interested in listening to NPR, including my own daughter who never listened to it before she was about 20 or 21, that now this is their primary source of news. There really are such things as NPR groupies. So it's like, yeah, I realize that. I appreciate the humor that's involved here, but I think maybe doing quality stuff may have something to do with that as well.
They do understand, Charles, the target they're going after, and their appeal is very clever. I mean, they're saying, are you interesting? Are you smart? Then we're going to hook you up with other smart people who are public radio listeners.
Yeah, and you expand the universe of smart people that can only be good for NPR, right? I mean, it makes sense to me.
I also thought there was a very interesting social media tie, and you can install this Facebook app and respond to five, I'd call them cheeky questions. And if you do, they will literally match you up with other people who's been on the app, and they say, you might be interested in, quote, hooking up with for coffee or procreation. Okay, whatever. And the app also has a little sidebar where you can click on a button and it will recommend for you programs that are on WBEZ based on how you answered those questions. So, well, yeah, we'll see how that plays out. Now, last but not least, we want to look this week at the annual ritual known as the Super Bowl commercial. You know most of the basics. It's the most watched TV program in the world, has the highest priced ads. This year, for example, sponsors are paying $4 million for a 30-second spot. But in recent years, the ritual has evolved some. You don't have to wait for the big game anymore to see many of the ads, or at least teases for them. Here, for example, is a bit featuring 30 Rock's Tracy Morgan. He's pitching the water flavoring called Mio Fit.
On the biggest sports night of the year, with countless millions watching, Mio Fit will be introduced by a new spokesperson.
Hey, can you say on TV?
Mercedes-Benz Super Bowl ad asking whether this guy is going to make a deal with the devil.
Nice car.
Sure is.
Make a deal with me, kid. You can have the car and everything that goes along with it.
So what's not to like? Sexy women, fast cars, good music. You know, the sponsors, you know, on both of these ads are trying to catch your attention with humor, with off-color language, with sex appeal. Nothing new there, Lee, but I just wonder what your take is on some of the ads you've seen so far there.
Some of the ads, okay, I've got to admit that studies of the Super Bowl show that the camera spends more time on the clock than it does on the football game. There are a lot of people who watch the Super Bowl so they can see the ads. And if it's a boring game, I have to admit that I become one of those people pretty quickly. So what I look at is one of the things I liked about the last ad you showed, Mike, is it's got something for every generation. Folks our age, we get sympathy for the devil. Younger people, they get the hip kid who gets the beautiful beautiful blonde. You know, it's got a little something for everybody there. And it's that, what I like to see is that creative process and how that just all kind of works out.
And in fact, what they're doing now, Charles, and I think most of us for the past few years have appreciated this, they're using social media like YouTube and Facebook and Twitter before and during the game so they can reach a larger audience. I mean, for $4 million, you want to have more impact than just the people who are going to watch that spot in 30 seconds in the Super
Bowl. Yeah, well, and it's how $4 million turns into $6 million pretty quickly because you buy the airtime, which is expensive enough, but then you got to do, what, a $500,000 social media pickup, and then you've got to run ads after that supporting your Super Bowl play because you can't just run it on Super Bowl Sunday or it's useless, right? So really, when you think about these spots, you got to think of them in terms of $6-7 million outlays. It always, to me, raises the question of effectiveness, whether you get enough pickup in business if you are Taco Bell to justify $7 million worth of media placement or $6 million. Interesting academic study, I think.
And there are some advertisers, I mean, who decide we're only going to tease the ad or run outtakes or whatever. There are a few advertisers who actually release the complete commercials ahead of time. That's what Volkswagen is doing again this year. But their spot is drawing criticism from some quarters.
I hate Mondays.
Yeah, they're the worst.
No worries, man. Everything will be all right.
Yeah, man.
Don't fret me, brother. Sticky bun comes soon. Yeah. Wicked coffee, Mr. Jim. Julia, turn the frown the other way around.
Hey, Dave, you're from Minnesota, right?
Yes, I. The land of 10,000 lakes. The Gopher State.
So in conclusion, things are pretty dismal.
You know what this room needs? A smile. Who wanna come with I?
Traveling along, there's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy.
You guys are 3 minutes late.
Don't be no cloud on a sunny day.
Yeah, chill, Winston.
Sir?
Respect, boss man.
We'll make you happy.
That's the power of German engineering.
Well, some people say that Volkswagen ad is cute. Some say it's boring. Some say it's racist. Reacting on CNN, for example, New York Times columnist Charles Blow says it's like blackface with voices. The Wall Street Journal's Christopher John Farley says it may be, quote, the Jar Jar Binks of 2013. Well, I'm not black or Jamaican, but, you know, Lee, I say maybe those guys should just get a life. What do you say?
I think they definitely should get a life. And I don't know whether that says more about me or the commercial. I find the commercial funny. I find the commercial a parody of so much stereotyping that it's hard for me to critique it as being stereotyping in and of itself. I think it's trying to play with me in some really pretty fun ways.
How about my gut reaction? I just watched it for the first time and thought they've taken identity and inverted it in a very clever way, and one that actually goes at racism and stereotypes.
Yeah. There is some thought, you know, Lee, that Volkswagen may actually use the feedback they get, whether it's, you know, people saying it's racist or not, and they could actually alter the ad that appears in the Super Bowl. So this strategy works for them either way.
It does. The other thing it's doing, and I am assuming that Volkswagen did this deliberately, is look at all the free media they're getting that they don't have to pay for, including minutes on this show and on many others where this ad has been discussed. I mean, when Charles is talking about it, you know, a $6-8 million outlay, this is money Volkswagen has not had to pay.
Well, and it's not just the advertisers who are getting, you know, extra free media. There are media companies, a lot of them in the news business especially, that are trying to use these spots to build their own ads, audiences rather. For example, you can go to Hulu now and they offer what they call the Super Bowl Ad Zone. It's sponsored by Toyota and you can watch all the previews of the ads. And USA Today has been doing this actually for a few years now. They've got something called the Ad Meter. Not only can you watch them, but you can rate them. You can sign up to be one of the people that takes part in their panel and then you can share those ads through the website. Well, let's hope that the game itself between the Ravens and the 49ers is as good as some of those commercials. Meanwhile, that's all the time we have for this week, so thank you for listening and watching. You can see or hear the show again. You can check out links related to our topics, or you can send us a comment via the Views blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also send an email to us at views@kbia.org. Our technical team, the always sure-handed Travis McMillan of RJI and Pat Akers of KBIA. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Charles Lee and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.